Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Stephen Zunis, and he will be speaking on Church and Middle East. So let's listen in on Stephen Zunis.
I think most people familiar with the area see Israeli-Palestinian conflict as not one over religion, though certainly there are extremist Jewish and extremist Muslim forces who've tried to make it that way, but essentially one of two competing nationalisms, Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs, which both have long-standing and, I believe, both legitimate claims to national self-determination. And the tragedy, through a variety of historical circumstances, which I would be happy to talk about in question and answers, have found themselves fighting over the same land. But how the church here in the West has responded has varied dramatically. Before I mention that, I want to talk about real brief about the church in the Middle East. Though the vast majority of Arabs are Muslims, there is a large Christian minority. Historically, the Christian minority in the Middle East has done fairly well. There has rarely been systematic persecution of Christians in predominantly Muslim countries. There have been some recent exceptions in Sudan. The Christian minority in the south has been oppressed quite brutally by the junta in Khartoum, though that oppression is at least as much because of racial and ethnic issues than religious ones. Also, of course, there's been conflict in Lebanon, though it's interesting that the so-called Christians in the fighting there, the Maronites, have been subject to violent attacks by Muslims, in large part because they have enjoyed an inordinate amount of power and influence in Lebanese societies, despite their minority status, and because most of them have subscribed to the Falangist movement, which is a neo-fascist party, which has engaged in widespread atrocities. Interestingly enough, the Protestants in Lebanon have often sided with the so-called Muslim side in some of the conflicts because they too have opposed the Falangist movement. Again, I can talk about Lebanon in more detail. With those exceptions, there have been Christian minorities. They have tended to prosper and do fairly well. About 20% of the Palestinian population is Christian, centered primarily around Jerusalem, Ramallah, Bethlehem, Beth Shahor, and as well as areas in the north in Galilee, which were taken over by Israel in 1948, are part of Israel proper, unlike these West Bank towns I mentioned, which are under military occupation but not formally part of Israel per se. Nazareth, for example, is in Israel, but it's a largely Arab city. And there are a number of other fairly large Christian populations in that part as well. Most of these people have been Christians for at least 400 years. Many of them go back as far back as the original Christians. In fact, these are the descendants, in many cases, of the original Christians. And the Israelis have, in their occupation policies, have oppressed the Palestinian Christians as much as they have the Palestinian Muslims. Being Palestinian is enough to get you in jail for a long time for political activity, violent or nonviolent, and they've had a rough time. In fact, there's been widespread emigration by Palestinian Christians. They can get out because more of the Christian Palestinians have relatives overseas than the Muslim Palestinians, so the number of Christians in Palestine itself has decreased quite a bit. Now maybe closer to 5%, even though 20% of Palestinians worldwide do tend to identify as Christians. One of the most amazing stories, and there's a book written by Virginia Barron, who's the former editor of Fellowship magazine, an ecumenical pacifist publication, about a tax strike in the Christian city of Beth Shahor, where like our forefathers and foremothers here in the United States of America, didn't like the idea of taxation without representation. The citizens of Beit Shahur refused to pay taxes to the Israeli occupation authorities and resisted in a very disciplined, nonviolent manner. No stone throwing, no, none of the violence they often associate with the Intifada. Indeed, most of the Intifada has been nonviolent, but in Beit Shahur they really kept it exclusively nonviolent. Despite this, the Israelis came in and clamped on a very, very brutal curfew. They broke into people's homes, stole family heirlooms or anything of value to pay for the back taxes. The organizers spent many, many months in prison. Some were tortured, yet they held fast to their commitment to non-violence and their refusal to pay taxes to finance their oppression. And it's a very powerful example of Christian witness in hard times. On the other hand, there have been some Christians that have taken up arms. The Anglican bishop was arrested by Israeli authorities for carrying explosives in his car. Some years, this is about 15, 20 years ago. He says he was framed. Maybe he was, but many people suspect he indeed had some ties to some of the armed resistance. Some of the most notorious PLO terrorist groups, like the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, those are the guys that used to hijack all those airliners, you may remember back in the early 1970s. It's led by George Habash, who's Greek Orthodox. And several other, even the more hardline leaders in the PLO, and some of the more radical factions are, in fact, of Christian background. So it's been a real mixed mixture in how Christian Palestinians have responded. I want to turn primarily to the role of the churches in North America. I want to divide it into sort of three parts. First, I want to look at the Christian fundamentalists, those that dominate the so-called Christian broadcasting networks and the like. They and Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and the like. Most of these people are dispensationalists. That is, they believe in a literal timetable for the final countdown and Armageddon and the second coming and the like. And for that to happen, they firmly believe that the ingathering of Jews through the Zionist movement and the creation of Israel in 1948 was a fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and have gone as far as defending Israel's expansion to wider areas. Falwell was talking about how the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, which killed nearly 18,000 civilians, was part of God's plan. The fundamentalist network is one of the most strong supporters of the Israeli government, particularly when the right-wing Likud party was in power, basically saying there should be no peace negotiations. God has settled the question. All that land belongs to Israel. In fact, Israel should take over even more of the land. Many of these people are advocates of, for example, destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Dome of the Rock because it's on the site of the Second Temple, which they believe needs to be rebuilt before Christ can come again. Indeed, a follower of Garner Ted Armstrong, a famous or infamous, depending on your opinion, radio evangelist, actually tried to burn down the Al-Aqsa Mosque back in the early 70s and nearly provoked a major Middle East war as a result. Falwell and Robertson have been major, have had a lot of influence among especially Republican administrations and members of the House and Senate to not condition any USA to Israel on international law or human rights or progress in peace negotiations, believing it should be unconditional. Their biggest impact, I think, in many ways, has been the sending of literally millions of American pilgrims to the Holy Land, where their tours of the holy sites are dosed with heavy uses of propaganda which justify the Israeli occupation. I've met people come back from these trips, and none of them ever met any Palestinians, or I've seen them at a distance. But it was always Israelis or Americans who were with them, accompanying them the whole time, never saw a refugee camp, you know, never saw, you know, the suffering of the Palestinians under population, but only depicted them as terrorists or, you know, nomads who could just as easily go off to Saudi Arabia or somewhere and et cetera. And most of them were not even aware they were Palestinian Christians. And the assumption was that they're all Muslims. But these people come back, show their slideshows, talk to their congregations, and you hear them on being interviewed on religious broadcasts and the like. So among the 40 million or so fundamentalist Christians in this country, there is this rather romantic notion of Israel and a very, with a light dose of anti-Arab and anti-Muslim racism. Indeed, I've heard Falwell and Robertson make comments about Islam that was equally as abhorrent as what Louis Farrakhan has said about Jews. But in this case, they weren't, you know, denounced by the media, and you didn't have George Bush being insisted that he denounce Falwell the way Jesse Jackson was told to denounce Farrakhan and that sort of thing. But you know, this is a very, very powerful force. One of the most extreme examples of their influence there is I was driving in southern Lebanon some years ago, turned the radio and heard gospel, American gospel music. And it was something called the Voice of Hope. It was this radio station that was financed through Pat Robertson and the High Adventures Mission in California. And it was in this part of southern Lebanon that was occupied by Israel with the help of a far right-wing Lebanese militia. And after the Christian broadcasting, along came General Haddad, who was the this right-wing renegade Lebanese major that the Israelis had sort of co-opted as a foreign regiment of the Israeli army, demanding that the Lebanese government pay him $20 million or he'd shell Sidon, which was a major city within artillery range of his forces. His group has also been responsible for killing scores of United Nations peacekeeping personnel. They're a notorious group. You know, they are funded through tax-deductible contributions and a collection plate of many American churches. And ironically, and the Israeli government actually brought in the trucks to help them set up this radio station, even though in their materials they say our purpose is to prepare the Jewish soul for the Messiah. See, they want to be there to cover the Second Coming live, and so they now have a television station and everything, so they can be there to when it happens. Indeed, ironically, many of these fundamentalists are themselves anti-Semitic. They actually say, let's encourage our Jewish friends to go to Israel, to immigrate, to make Aliyah. In other words, let's not have them live next door. Let's have them go there. So then when Christ comes, they'll convert to Christianity, and we'll have the whole, you know, 1,000 years of Christ's reign, etc. So that's one end of the church. On the other end, you have the historic peace churches, the Quakers, the Mennonites, the Brethren, who've long had connections in the Middle East. The Quakers have had a school for many years, two schools actually, a girls' school and a boys' school in Ramallah, which is a traditionally Christian town in the West Bank, early missionary work from there. Both the American Friends Service Committee, the Mennonite Central Committee, and I believe as well the Brethren Volunteer Service have been very active in administering to Palestinian refugees. The Quakers were also very active in supporting, helping Jewish refugees from World War II and the relocation camps following the liberation of the concentration camps and helping people move on to what was then Palestine. Indeed, the AFSC won the Nobel Peace Prize along with their British counterpart, Quaker Peace and Service, for their work with Jewish refugees. But the peace churches are, you know, have long thought instead of just charity that they need to speak out on issues of injustice, and they have very strongly, very firmly supporting Israel's right to exist, very, you know, very strongly seeing the need for a Jewish national homeland, but also recognizing that a country's right to exist does not give them a right to invade, exploit, oppress. And arguing equally adamantly that Palestinian Arabs also have a right to statehood, and that the United States and other nations must stop this tradition of sending massive amounts of armaments to the region, and should instead work for peace, a peace where Arab states would recognize Israel and Israel would recognize Palestine. The Quakers are the first to come out, this is an official statement, in a book called Search for Peace in the Middle East. There's a more recent version of that, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's on sale in the bookstore prominently in the recommended section when you come into the A Compassionate Peace, that's the name of it, A Compassionate Peace. And it's a little dated, this version, the edition is about 5 years old, but still very, very good reading. It's one of those, the best all-around books for introductory books on the Middle East, and I'd recommend you all look at it if you want to explore this subject further. But when Search for Peace came out in 1971, it was subjected to blistering and indeed slanderous attack by the more establishment Jewish community. The very suggestion that the Palestinians might have as much right as Israelis to self-determination was seen as an attack on Israel, indeed an anti-Semitic plot. And the attacks were so vicious, and the book was misquoted, and still continues to be misquoted from this day, with quotes taken out of context. It was one of the again, nastier, and indeed slanderous attacks I've witnessed between religious communities in this country. It got a lot of the mainline churches who were getting ready to make their own positions a little scared. They didn't want to have to go through that. But eventually, by the late 70s, early 80s, most of all the mainline churches, as well as the Protestant church, as well as the Catholic church, had come out with statements, some of them fairly short, some of them more involved, which essentially agreed with what the Quakers and the other historic peace churches had said. A number came out with some very interesting study guides. This the Lutherans put out in 1987, I believe. It's called Two Peoples, the Same Land, a study of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There's a series of articles, outstanding. I don't know if it's still in print.
Yeah,
but it's
from Augsburg Press.
Yeah. It was one of the best short surveys on Israel-Palestine you could ask for. They did a very good job. It covers a whole variety of issues. It looks at the Palestinian Christians. It looks at the where they come from politically. There's a critique of U.S. Middle East policy. There's talks about both the moral and political travesty of terrorism, the power of forgiveness, the right-wing Christian fundamentalist support for Israeli expansionism. They look at nonviolent alternatives, look at the role of the UN. It runs the gamut in only like 40, 45 pages. So an excellent synopsis. Yet, even though the Lutheran Church, and again most of the mainline churches, have come out with good statements, good publications, and often the work there in the field has been excellent, working with their sister churches in the Holy Land, often having volunteer services helping not just poor Palestinians, but also Jewish immigrants and the like. Very few people in sort of the rank and file know much about the church's position. Last week I did a whole series of things on Israel-Palestine, and the vast majority of people who were at what I said were, this was new information to them totally. And these tend, I mean, the type of people who come to Holden Village are a type who tend to be pretty involved in their churches, and relative to average church people tend to be more aware of some of these broader social and political issues. But and this is not surprising, I found this everywhere I've gone, just about, some of the very people who could tell you everything about El Salvador or Nicaragua or about Namibia or South Africa or about, all these other issues where the church has expressed concern. On the Middle East, their eyes kind of glaze over. Even though, again, we have this special, and it's all the more ironic given the special attachment we have as Christians to the Holy Land. And to my knowledge, that neither the Lutheran Church nor any of the other churches, which again have come out with some very good statements and very good material, have really tackled this one with the same kind of energy and resources that Central America or the arms race or Namibia or, you know, apartheid or some of the other issues which have, you know, captured the imagination and concern of people. And I think there are a number of reasons for this. One was the early Quaker experience. Here we are, you know, with centuries of anti-Semitism behind us, feeling a fair amount of guilt and responsibility and a real determination for good reasons for Christian-Jewish dialogue, recognizing the Jewish roots of our faith, reaching out to our Jewish brethren. And, what's the female equivalent for brethren? I don't know. Try to use inclusive language when I can, but whatever. brothers and sisters of the Jewish faith. To say something about the Middle East often will break down in a very short order these tenuous ties we've been trying to build. We don't want to be accused of anti-Semitism. We don't want to cut off this dialogue. And it's concerned something that may seem perfectly reasonable, that maybe the U.S. should tie some of its aid to Israel, ending its systematic and gross human rights violations. That sounds perfectly reasonable. We feel that way because most of us feel that way about any country that receives U.S. aid. But to many Jews who see Israel as a besieged country about to be overrun by the Arab hordes, the suggestion of withdrawing aid sees, you want Israel wiped out. You want overrun, defeated. Similarly, if we say the Palestinians should have their own state in the West Bank and Gaza alongside Israel, we say it because we believe in the self-determination of any oppressed people, same reason we felt South Africa should pull out of Namibia. But, you want a base for terrorists to launch, you know, into Israel. Now, one can certainly, you know, argue that Israel's so strong militarily, and any Palestinian mini-state in the West Bank and Gaza would be so weak militarily that these security concerns don't really have any real justification. But still, that's the feeling. And given the history of persecution of the Jews, it's not surprising that feeling is widespread. So I think people realize that if we take on the Middle East, we're going to be attacked. There's going to be some discord. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. I think what it requires is that we do a lot of listening, that we reiterate our belief in Israel's survival. We reiterate that our concerns we might have with some Israeli policies are based, you know, not on the fact that Israel is a Jewish state, because we're concerned about any country that has those kind of policies, including Arab states, which of course have their own pretty notorious record of in terms of human rights and militarism and the like. And I think if we can maintain that balance and are real thoughtful in how we communicate and not get scared when we get and intimidated when we get attacked, I think we can make some inroads and do the kind of work that needs to be done, because I fear if those of us in the church do not speak out more on this issue, it'll be left to the real anti-Semites. It will be left to right-wing isolationists. It'll be left to people who have, whose concerns about this part of the world do not come from the more universal truth that we seek regarding peace and justice everywhere else in the world. So I want to put this forth as a challenge to encourage that those of us to get more involved in our churches, bring in speakers, bring in literature, get people involved in the way and try to play a role influencing our government's policy, because as I've argued in my other sessions, I believe the U.S. government policy has been most unhelpful in bringing peace in the region Indeed, I've made a number of analogies of Clinton's policy in the Middle East to the Reagan administration policy in Central America. And I can elaborate on that in discussion if you want, but those of you who weren't at my forum on Monday night. But why don't I stop it here? And I would welcome questions or comments or suggestions or disagreements or whatever people have to offer.
What do you think about Arafat's chances now to bring peace there?
Well, for a long time, in fact, way back to the mid-70s, Arafat had made hints that he was willing to recognize Israel in turn for Israel recognizing Palestine. But and it's been almost 15 years since he or his faction have been responsible for any acts of terrorism. So he's been moderating for quite a long time. The trouble was with the U.S.-backed far right-wing government Israel that these peace overtures were ignored. Indeed, the U.S. refused to allow Arafat to even come to the U.N. to ask Israel to make peace, much less talk to the PLO. And we were the self-appointed chief negotiators, and we said, no, we won't let one of the two parties take part. Indeed, when we set up the Madrid peace conference, we exclusively forbid the PLO from taking part. That's why Israel had to meet secretly with the PLO in a third country to get anywhere. And so finally there is movement, and I think it was only because Israel realized it was in their interest to try to make peace. The problem is that the Oslo Accords are rather vague, and because they're vague, it gives the advantage to those who have the power, namely Israelis who occupy the West Bank and Gaza, and the United States, which is the supplies the money and arms and diplomatic cover to make that occupation possible. And so Arafat's essentially given away all the cards the PLO has. You know, stop the armed resistance, unilaterally recognize Israel, you know, but what more, you know, it's not like they can give a lot more. Now, what Clinton administration in Israel says, give up on having your own state. Accept this limited autonomy comparable to a South African Bantustan, where you can, you know, give out, you know, marriage licenses and pick up the garbage, but Israel can veto any law, can veto any elected or appointed official, can intervene with its troops anytime it wants to, where the settlers can have, you know, at least half the land and some of the best land, and can run around as armed vigilantes and, you know, death squads in some cases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's clearly, and also the greater Jerusalem will become part of Israel proper, not part of West Bank. Of course, Jerusalem is the center of Palestine as much as is the center of Israel. The center not just for religious reasons, but for commerce and health care and education, and, you know, it's the only big city on the West Bank. Indeed, right now, Christians in Ramallah and Bethlehem cannot go into Jerusalem to visit the holy places because the Israelis have sealed that area. In many ways, it's ironic because when Jordan occupied East Jerusalem back before 1967, they barred the Jews from going to their holy places. And now it's kind of the other way around. So Arafat somehow has to convince the people that something good can come out of this. And he may have a hard task. Now, part of it's Arafat's fault, because one thing that the Intifada did was that it was much more than just kids throwing stones. It's also creating a large amount of autonomous Palestinian institutions separate from Israeli rule. Now, these are illegal. For example, they tried to have garden clubs so they could be more self-sufficient in food, not buy from the Israelis, health cooperatives, other kinds of, you know, grassroots democratic institutions. Now, membership of those institutions could lend somebody in 5 years in jail, because the Israelis recognized that these were actually more of a threat than kids throwing stones, because it was a quasi-Palestinian state in the making. But what this was not just a struggle for independence from Israeli occupation, but also in many ways it was a social revolution within a rather conservative, feudalistic Palestinian society. Indeed, women took on the leadership of many of these grassroots institutions, which, you know, challenged many of the traditional and rather limited role of women in Palestine. So here you have this flowering of these grassroots democratic institutions, and then here comes Arafat and his guys back from exile saying, okay, thanks guys, we'll take over now. I'll appoint the people. These are all the PLO honchos who are in Tunis, you know, which is like 1,200 miles away, you know, and these guys will run things. And the people, the grassroots, are saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, and we expressed our loyalty to the PLO all these years because you guys were, for better or worse, our government in exile. But that doesn't mean you can come here and take over. Within the Palestinian community right now, Arafat's rather autocratic style and some corruption and stuff. Now, on one hand, this is a good sign. I think it shows that if there is an independent Palestine, it will not be like other Arab states, because what other Arab state do you know people where the leading intellectuals and other activists will openly criticize their leadership like that? I mean, you don't see Syrian intellectuals saying, Assad, you're too autocratic and corrupt. I mean, you know, they'd be dead if they tried, you know. But so in a sense, it shows that there is a democratic vitality, at least, that people are challenging this. But at the same time, it hurts his credibility even further. Now, many of these dissidents, you know, support peace with Israel. Some of the dissidents do not. But that's the other problem he has. Not just that Israel and the U.S. will not compromise the way I believe they need to compromise for things to get anywhere, but also I think Arafat's old boy network and their lack of attention to the grassroots.
I get the feeling he doesn't have much of a chance, though, because of assassination problems.
I can't rule that out, but I think in many ways it's overstated. I mean, it's been problematic because his top lieutenants have been murdered by the Israelis over the years. The Israelis have assassinated a number of top PLO officials, including leading moderates, and also some extremist Palestinians like Abu Nidal have assassinated some leading PLO officials as well. So, you know, there is a history of assassination, but and it could happen again, but I think it's more likely if he fails, it'll fail because people no longer respect his leadership, not because he's physically eliminated from the picture.
Seems like to me that we know a lot about the history of the Jews. We know more about the history of the Jews than we know about the history of the Arabs, too, which may cause some of our problems within the church of understanding the Arab problem. Mm-hmm. And also then we have the mass media, and legitimately so, reporting on terrorism.
Yeah.
The Pan American 101 or 103 flight, the bombing, the taking of the embassy in Iran, and these other incidents of terrorism, which seems to put me and more in alliance with the Jews than in alliance with the Arabs, because I don't really understand their history.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's rather interesting. You hear, you know, many, you know, some Arab states and especially Islamic extremists, you know, justifying for terrorism. You say, how can they do that? But, you know, I remember Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell talking, supporting the Contras. And the Contras killed far more civilians than any Palestinian, Arab, or Muslim groups the past 20 years combined. I mean, anywhere is up to 15,000 Nicaraguan civilians were killed by this U.S. armed, trained, supplied terrorist group. We always hear, you remember, there's great stories, all the press, when, say, a Palestinian terrorist group crossed the border and got a collective farm up in Galilee and killed Jewish hostages. Well, that happened every week in Nicaragua. Contras across from Honduras and they take a collective farm in northern Nicaragua, and their collective farms are just like the Kibbutzim, they're democratic cooperative things, and kill people, including children. That didn't get in our headlines because the Contras were freedom fighters, right? I think, you know, that the media coverage has given us this distorted view. Indeed, the Israelis have killed far more civilians, Palestinian civilians and Lebanese civilians, than the Palestinians have, or Lebanese have killed Israeli civilians. But of course, they have these sleek jet fighters supplied by the American taxpayer that can just drop napalm or cluster bombs into a refugee camp or a village. That's far away from the media limelight. It's not like Munich or, you know, or an embassy or an air, or whatever. So but of course, you know, this is true in many cases in insurgency and count versus counterinsurgency kind of situation. It's a Viet Cong terrorist who throws a hand grenade into a marketplace, but it was a protective reaction strike when we bomb a school or a hospital in North Vietnam. I think it does make it difficult to get the balance that I think is important to have there.
Which Arab states are supporting the Palestinians?
Well, in theory, all support the Palestinians. But not all of them support the PLO. Only one or two have actually supported the radical wings of the PLO, most of which have since split from the PLO, that have engaged in terrorism. And those are Iraq and Libya. And until about 6 or 7 years ago, Syria. Almost all the terrorists in the past 15 years have been by small freelance operations, some with ties to Libyan intelligence or Iraqi intelligence or whatever.
Are these Arab states supporting a Palestinian state then?
Yeah, yes.
And with Syria, that's why we're talking to Syria now?
Well, ironically, the PLO has had a more moderate position than Syria for years, but we invited Syria into the peace talks, but not the PLO. Just like we armed Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, who've been supporting Hamas, the radical Palestinian faction, while refusing to talk to the moderates. So, our policy has really been pretty distorted, I find.
Literally, they were people without a country.
Yeah.
And that's probably the reason they weren't invited.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like the Jews were for 70 years. I mean, the Jews did not give up on their idea of a national homeland for 2,000 years. The Palestinians certainly aren't going to give up after 40. And I think the United States has to face that.
Yeah, the Roman Catholics in the Concordat of Tripoli in 1973 reconciled with Islam by arguing that there is no conflict in Catholic doctrine and the Quran. Mm-hmm. Muhammad was a prophet and there's only one God. Mm-hmm. What progress have Protestants made in that direction and why haven't they reconciled?
Not a lot. I think part of it is ignorance. I mean, I gave a couple workshops on Islam last week. And there are people here who didn't realize that Allah was God. I mean, Allah is simply the Arabic word for God. A lot of people thought Allah was some kind of, I don't know, idol or something else. Nor they realized the role of the Old Testament prophets or Jesus in the Quran. But indeed, the very close, many people see Islam as some kind of heathen whatever, instead of being at least as closely tied to Christianity as Judaism is. And I've applauded and I participated in the dialogue the church has had with Jews, and I think it's very, very important. We need to do that with Muslims as well, particularly as conflicts between the Muslim world and the West increase, and the number of American Muslims grows dramatically. And there are more American Muslims than there are Episcopalians now. It's a very fast-growing religion, and these are our neighbors. And they need to be included in our interfaith councils and other organizations we're involved in.
Why doesn't the Protestant church read the Quran? I mean, if you read it, it's straight prophetic.
Yeah, it's good.
All the stuff that's advertised is not there.
Yeah.
It is actually returned to the covenant without promises. Mm-hmm. And I look upon the Quran as what the Quran was to Christians is what the prophets were to Moses.
Yeah.
And it's the return to covenant, absolute, all-powerful, unknowable God. Mm-hmm. And you can't create a plastic bubble that you want to call your own. Mm-hmm. Eden is not ours to create. And it's very clear about that. And that's mm-hmm. a very simple message, and it could be a very healthy one. Mm-hmm. I suspect strongly what we built is plastic bubbles called congregations and whatever else that do not want to deal with an all-powerful, unknowable mm-hmm. God.
I think we can learn, just as many Christians getting, learning more about Judaism have gotten into some fundamental truths that we may have lost. I think, as you mentioned, we can do similar things with Islam. And when people read the Quran, they say, hey, they realize there's nothing in there that says anything about terrorism. There's nothing in there that says anything about women behind veils. Now, this is a bunch of cultural I mean, most Muslims I know, including devout Muslims, look upon Khomeini and some of these extremist reactionary fundamentalist movements the same way most of us would look at, Falwell and Robertson. These are political reactionaries who are using distorted and out of context scriptural passages to support their own narrow ideological agenda, and are not representative of the faith as a whole. Indeed, Islam is as diverse as Christianity, and you get some real hardcore people that can really turn you off, but you also see people who are one with God in some very, very inspiring ways.
But for example, we were in Indonesia, and I was the first one to bring this to the attention. That's a Muslim nation.
Mm-hmm. Largest Muslim nation.
That the Catholics had reconciled. And the Muslims knew none of that. The Pope's subsequent encyclical, of course, says there's no salvation outside the church, but he doesn't read his own documents. And the possibility of the dialogue that developed was sensational.
Yeah.
And we started dealing with the concept of what a Muslim peace would look like.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of debate on how much can one reconcile, you know, to what degree, etc. But even though I'm sure there's going to be a diversity of opinions on that within the church, I think clearly we can do no wrong by greater dialogue and greater understanding of Islam. I think that's really the key. Brother Fox.
We had a Jewish speaker that I heard once was commenting on the water issue in the Middle East and how that's a big issue between the kind of factions as well. Can you make any comments about that? Or is it just accessibility to water?
I personally think the water issue is overblown. And I say that because part of it, for example, in the West Bank, Israeli settlements will get swimming pools, all the water they want, and the nearby Arab village will have their well dry up because the settlements say up the aquifer up the water table from where the well is, and the Israelis refuse to give them a permit to drill a new well as a deliberate way of essentially driving people out of the village, forcing them to emigrate or whatever. And this has been done, and you know, the Israelis have manipulated water quite a bit to dry out the Arabs and, you know, make these real luxurious kind of things for the Jewish settlers and the like. I think, though, that there have been some real important innovations, both by the Israelis in the Negev and in Abu Dhabi down in the United Arab Emirates, of using drip irrigation agriculture and other water conservation issues that, if done equitably, could use the water resources they have. And yeah, you'd have to be conscientious about your use, but could be done for what people need to do and survive well. Also, they're right by the Mediterranean. Desalinization costs a lot of money, but if they stop spending so darn much on weapons and on occupation, they had plenty of money to build all the desalinization plants they needed, which would supply more than enough potable water to the area. Also, regional agreements, for example, with the Turks, the big dams are building up on the headwaters of the Euphrates. There are a variety of connections with the Litani River up in Lebanon, and water can be a problem if there's a continued state of war, but with peace, there's water, as with a lot of other things, could be resolved a lot easier. In many ways, people are using the water issue as an excuse. I mean, now the Palestinians have recognized them and declared no war and everything like that. I think there's some Israelis who are trying to look for an excuse why they still have to hold. And also, now long-range artillery makes, you know, holding on to this, in these buffers, they're called buffer zones, irrelevant. You know, I think there's some people who are still desperately searching for an excuse not to make peace, frankly. Indeed, sorry.
Well, I was thinking about the arms merchants. We're supplying those people with arms.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't we part of the problem?
Very much so. The United States has sent nearly $40 billion worth of new, highly sophisticated arms to the Middle East since the Gulf War alone. We are responsible for 80% of all the arms transfers to the region. We are virtually the sole outside provider to Israel. Almost all their countries have an arms moratorium in Israel since they invaded and occupied neighboring countries. But we're also the chief arms supplier to Arab states, including some very, very autocratic monarchies like in the Gulf. Also a country like Morocco, who, like Israel, has invaded a neighbor, in this case the country of Western Sahara, in violation of UN resolutions. We armed the Turks despite the brutal repression against the Kurds and their occupation of the northern third of Cyprus. We big arms supplier to Egypt. In fact, we were even arming Saddam Hussein to a lesser extent until he got out of favor big time with his takeover of Kuwait. We secretly armed the Ayatollahs in Iran.
What is our excuse? It sponsors jobs. That's our favorite excuse.
And influence. But I think, you know, my personal opinion is that there are some very serious ethical and political drawbacks to this kind of policy. And indeed, I think it's a moral travesty.
That's right.
The United States spends millions of dollars, and there are thousands of people on U.S. government payroll whose sole job it is to promote U.S. arms sales overseas. Clinton spent tens of millions of dollars financing an arms bazaar in Singapore where the U.S. arms merchants could show off their stuff to customers, the majority of whom were from governments with gross and systematic human rights records of gross and systematic human rights violations.
Maybe we have to clean our own house.
Yeah, indeed. I think in Middle East peacemaking, again, I think ultimately, of course, I believe that the Israelis and Palestinians need to come together themselves. But I argue that the United States is a major part of the problem. And so the role of the churches, I believe, is not kind of going over there and telling Israelis and Palestinians what they should do, but to challenge our own government's policies, the way that it makes peace harder to reach. The way we, you know, for example, when I hear people knock Israel, and again, there are a lot of things to criticize the Israeli government for, I basically say, any country that has tried to do the things Israel's tried to do, that is, invade and occupy neighboring countries, suppress the population, thumb its nose at the UN, violate the most fundamental principles of international law, have a military budget that's this humongous percentage of their gross national product, keep almost all their men under arms at least part of the year, trying to keep people down, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Almost any country who tried to do that would collapse for economic grounds alone, or be subjected to internal rebellion, or be subjected to external invasion, or some kind of international sanctions, or whatever. But because the United States gives Israel this diplomatic, military, and economic umbrella, it can get away with that. So of course it brings out some of the worst elements in Zionism, some of the worst elements in Israeli society, because if you don't have to pay for your mistakes, you know, why should you reconsider it? You can keep electing the people who pursue those policies, and the peace people say, hey, maybe this is wrong, maybe this is for moral reasons, maybe it's wrong for our own self-interest, who can say, huh, what's to worry about? You know, we're not hurting for it. So again, I would, as I encourage people in the churches to get more involved, I encourage them to get involved more in terms of looking at our policy. Because I think the U.S. relation to Israel is comparable to, the United States is a friend of Israel. I support that 100%. What does a friend do if their friend has had a lot to drink, grabs the keys, and is staggering towards the car? You got to say, hey, wait a minute. I'm not going to let you do that. I'm not going to let you hurt yourself or other people. But not, for the United States policy up to now, it's not only have we let them drive, we've supplied the alcohol. And so again, I'm not saying we should be less pro-Israel. I'm saying we should redefine what being pro-Israel is. For those of you who didn't come in earlier, I have flyers from my brochure. And just let me make a plug that I am happy and available to come to places like Holden Village, to individual congregations, to synod meetings, to any kind of organized activity where people who want to think about and consider these issues. I'm happy to be a consultant. There are some very good people in the Middle East Task Force, the Lutheran Church, Carol Berkland and others, who are doing and have done and continue to do some excellent work. There's some very good resources out there. I have, you know, if it's unfeasible or not economically possible to bring me to a certain place, I know a lot of good people, Muslims, Jews, and Christians, including some Lutherans who can do similar good work. Fill out the back of this if you haven't. I have a literature list if you want to catch up on your information. Again, this is one of the best sources available. Again, if you want a more detailed one, which looks at the broader Middle East, I recommend A Compassionate Peace, which is there in the bookstore. The Lutheran one?
Yeah.
It's called Two Peoples, the Same Land. The study of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
When you were talking earlier about the millions of dollars that we spend on arms for the Middle Eastern countries, mm-hmm. It sort of points up the whole rotten political system from the standpoint of the amount of money that's paid to lobbyists and the amount of money that's contributed to the re-election of certain key people who serve on powerful committees, that they totally warped the whole system, that the grassroots doesn't have that kind of money to influence political opinion, and it's so difficult to overcome what you know is the rotten way of doing things. Mm-hmm. In Oregon, we have two senators who were bought and paid for by the lumber industry. Yeah. When they come up for re-election, millions of dollars goes into the political coffers. Mm-hmm. And those people who are environmentalists that oppose the policies of the lumber and timber industries can't mm-hmm. come up with the kind of money that Georgia-Pacific and mm-hmm. Louisiana-Pacific.
At the same time, it's though we're no match for the money, we do have the numbers. The vast majority of Americans support a two-state solution with Israel-Palestine. The vast majority of Americans support cutting back the arms trade. Indeed, 60% of American Jews support Palestinian statehood now. In fact, you get more votes for Palestinian statehood in the Israeli Knesset than you can in the U.S. Congress. And the Israeli Knesset is about fifth the size of the U.S. Congress. And so I think there's that, any movement, if we've saw around on any number of issues, that they start small with the grassroots, grossly out-moneyed, grossly out-influenced, but people grow. It starts small. It starts in the church basements. It starts with individual conversations with speakers, with slideshows, the evenings with letter writing campaigns, and eventually it becomes a mass movement. And
it's just so hard to get from there to changing the vote
it can shift if people realize that. No matter how slick their advertising is, you're not going to vote for them, or at least not going to volunteer give money to them if they keep upholding policies that you find morally reprehensible. And I think you'll find that even some of the otherwise very, very progressive members of Congress have pretty outrageous positions on the Middle East. The reasons are a little complex, but it's real frightening how many people who've been real strong in human rights when it comes to Central America have been supported oppression in the Middle East.
Isn't part of it though oil? Their need for oil?
Yeah,
need to maintain the status quo to keep mm-hmm. the oil supply coming.
And also to keep Israel as a strong U.S. surrogate in that critical region. But again, it's heartening to see a good devout Lutheran like Paul Simon, who's stuck his neck out on El Salvador and Namibia and all these other places, rationalize for Israeli repression and deny the Palestinians' right to statehood. But we run into that. He's a senator from Illinois.
Yeah, there's also senators and congressmen that are completely bought by the grassroots special interest groups.
Yeah, and there is
Minnesota just by yeah. single.
Yeah, and they're single issue groups, including some right-wing Jewish organizations that do have influence. I personally think that their power is often exaggerated, but in some cases there is indeed a lot of clout there. But again, I think we do have the numbers, and I think most importantly we're right. I mean, I think the consensus that the mainline churches and the peace churches have come on this is just, and there's nothing too radical about this. Human rights, self-determination, international law, I mean, that's hard. You know, that's not an exclusively left-wing agenda by any means. I mean, that's, I think we, you know, people can rally around that those pretty easily. So we're not talking about anything too far-fetched. So I think we got a good message here. We just need to overcome the prejudices, the media biases, the, you know, politicians, the usual, you know, cast of characters. But we've done it before in other issues. I think we can do this again. Again, I think the church is their special responsibility. So I hope you all will educate yourselves and invite me or somebody to come to appropriate gatherings and continue your good work.
Do you have opportunities to meet? I don't know what state you're from.
I live here in Washington. But I travel all over.
Do you have access to a representative in Congress? Yeah, face-to-face, one-on-one.
Somewhat, but my institute's a 501c3 nonprofit group, so I can't lobby.
Oh.
My role is public education, and hope from there people will go and do the lobbying or this stuff. But I think given how much confusion there is right now about this issue, and misinformation and whatever, I think we're still at the public education phase as really what needs to be done the most right here. And again, I have confidence that a political change can arise spontaneously as more and more people become aware and empowered and the like. So thank you so much for coming. And again, I have flyers for those of you who didn't get them, and I'll be happy to talk informally now or at a meal or whenever. And also, please come to the subsequent forums tomorrow and Friday if you're interested.
That was really a good talk.
At the time, this is January 93, they were concerned with, you know, not knowing where they were going to land and all of this. I'm not sure they know now, but the concern then was because of the multiple, you know, at least four radical factions within the PLO at the time.
Yeah.
They saw their, you know, they were going to lose the situation, no matter what happened, they were going to lose.
Yeah.
What do you think, where are they at now? Is it any clearer where... what their fate is
of the Israeli Arabs?
The Israeli Arab Christians, in particular.
I think they're